From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 23 of NIH Research Radio with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, our first one for 2007, we'll have a story about how staying in shape mentally can help older folk maintain their thinking skills, according to a new study funded by the National Institute on Aging and the National Institute of Nursing Research. And speaking of aging, it's a common misperception that depression is just another part of getting older. We'll tell you about some new information on the NIH Senior Health website designed to battle that unfortunate stereotype. I'll sit down with Dr. Harrison Wine, editor of the NIH News and Health, to discuss the January issue. Wally Akinso has a story on how results from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute's Growth and Health Study suggest that overweight girls as young as 9 are at increased risk for short-term and long-term problems that increase the chances of developing cardiovascular disease. Also, the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism has an updated guide that provides tools that can be used by clinicians to help patients with alcohol problems. But first, the first human trial of a DNA vaccine designed to prevent H5N1 avian influenza infection began last month when the vaccine was administered to the first volunteer at the NIH Clinical Center here in Bethesda, Maryland. I'll tell you all about it coming up next on NIH Research Radio. At the NIH, we know there's much to be learned from families, especially where one brother or sister has rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, or myositis, and the other does not. Now, does that sound like your family? Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116. If you're eligible, study-related tests are free. You'll be compensated for your time, and transportation may be reimbursed. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The first human trial of a DNA vaccine designed to prevent H5N1 avian influenza infection began on December 21, 2006, when the vaccine was administered to the first volunteer at the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. Scientists from the Vaccine Research Center at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases designed the vaccine. So, what's the difference between a typical flu vaccine and a DNA vaccine? Here's Dr. Gary Nabel, director of the Vaccine Research Center.
DNA vaccine is a new technology that we've used more recently in vaccine design. What we do is we use DNA that we grow in the laboratory, and we engineer it in such a way that it expresses a specific protein from the virus. And that's done independent of the whole virus. So in other words, we cut out a little piece of one of the genes from the virus and express only that one protein. That's in contrast to the traditional flu vaccine, which is actually the entire virus that's been grown in chicken eggs and then inactivated with a couple of chemicals.
As of December 27th, 261 lab-confirmed human cases of H5N1 had been reported to the World Health Organization, resulting in the death of more than half of the infected individuals. While human cases remain relatively rare and are largely the result of direct virus transmission from infected birds, a few cases of human-to-human transmission have also been reported. If there were to be a large-scale outbreak of the so-called bird flu, would a vaccine like the one being tested serve as a stopgap until such time as a vaccine for the specific strain of virus in a pandemic could be produced?
Well, it really depends on how effective the vaccine is. If the vaccine is highly effective, then it might be a new vaccine that could be used on its own. If it isn't effective at all, obviously that's not much of a stopgap. If it's somewhere in between, we would need to look at whether it would be good enough on its own or whether we might use it in different prime boost combinations. We'll need to just gather the data and see where in the spectrum it will be able to contribute.
The study will enroll 45 volunteers between the ages of 18 and 60. 15 will receive placebo injections, 30 will receive 3 injections of the investigational vaccine over 2 months, and will be followed for a year. Volunteers will not be exposed to influenza virus. For more information or to enroll, visit www.clinicaltrials.gov or call the Vaccine Research Center toll-free at 866-833-LIFE. Obesity is a problem faced by folks across all age groups. Wally Akinso has a story about a study that shows how early obesity affects girls.
Results from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute's Growth and Health Study suggest that overweight girls as young as 9 are at increased risk for short-term and long-term problems that increase the chances of developing cardiovascular disease. More than 2,300 girls ages 9 and 10 were enrolled in the study and followed for more than 10 years. The study also provides insight into differences between African American and Caucasian girls, according to Dr. Eva Obrazanik, a NHLBI research nutritionist.
First, we saw that at every age, the black girls had twice the rate of overweight than white girls. And also, as they were getting older, there were more and more girls who were overweight. So what we saw was that there were new cases of overweight with each year, and that rate of new cases was more during the younger years than the older years. So that was a very glaring finding. So between the ages of 9 and 12, about 2 to 5% of more girls were becoming overweight. After age 12, that rate of becoming overweight was down to just 1 to 2% per year.
The girls who were overweight were more likely to have elevated blood pressure and cholesterol levels compared to girls who were not. Dr. Obrazanik said girls who were overweight during childhood were 11 to 30 times more likely than non-overweight girls to be obese in young adulthood. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, Dr. Harrison Wine fills us in on what can be found in the January edition of the NIH News and Health. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Got a youngster around the house who's on the heavy side but is otherwise healthy? The National Institutes of Health would like to talk to you to see what they can learn from your child. Not only are all study-related tests and treatments provided for free, but all participants are compensated. Check out clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. NIH is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Here we are, the first podcast of 2007, and I'm joined by... Why are you looking through my papers, Harrison?
I'm looking for secret things.
Harrison's in my office. Dr. Harrison Wine, the editor of the NIH News and Health, and he sits down in my office studio and immediately begins rifling through my very important papers.
I just...
I don't come to your office and rifle through your papers,
maybe,
sir.
Maybe we just need a snappier intro, Bill.
Well, be that as it may, what's in this thing this time? The NIH News and Health. And, well, this actually seems like a very topical topic. The holidays have come and gone, and stress is the order of the day. This issue deals with stress.
It's basically about the science behind stress. Once people really debated how stress affected you, and, you know, the whole idea that stress can affect your body, but research has pretty much settled that idea. I mean, we know that stress affects... Well, the people who said stress affects your body.
Okay.
It affects many systems, and immunologists and neurologists and neurobiologists have, you know, basically all agree and are studying the effects now.
So is stress a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, a little stress can be good. I mean, you always need a little stress when you're going to give a talk or you're going to perform at an event. Without stress, you wouldn't really ever get ready. And it's your body's way of gearing up. But obviously too much stress too often is too much.
So what's the practical advice then for the reader of this article on stress?
A big problem these days is sleep deprivation. Mm-hmm. Sleep deprivation really throws off your hormone systems.
And that seems to be a disease of this particular decade as well.
Modern life just includes a lot of sleep deprivation. And it really affects your mood, your ability to make decisions, and causes other behaviors that lead to worse health. And one of the main things in stress research that we're realizing now is that just being in better shape helps with the way you deal stress. Your body is more able to handle stresses.
So even just taking a walk or light exercise is a way of sloughing off the stress, as it were.
Yeah, it's sloughing off the stress and also sort of making you better able to prepare. Eat better, get sleep, get exercise. Your body is just better able to handle things that come unexpectedly. Another major factor that research is showing is the idea of building support networks. People who have good support networks, who can blow off steam, who have people who they can talk to about their daily problems, tend to live longer and have all kinds of measures of health that tend to be better.
A little box on page 2 here, wise choices, ways of reducing stress. Why don't you touch on those?
Oh, basically, it's a lot of classic advice.
Stuff we've heard before, but you can't hear too often.
Absolutely. Get enough sleep, exercise, control your diet, build a social support network, as I mentioned before. Create peaceful times in your day. A lot of people just don't take the time to do that, and it is very important. And it's important to try different relaxation methods until you find one that works for you. And also, there's the old don't smoke and don't drink too much or abuse any other substances because they throw your body off balance, too, and make you much more susceptible to the effects of stress.
Well, you work just down the hallway from me, so when you see my door closed, you'll know I'm in here taking your advice.
Right, exactly.
This is one of those multi-topic issues. You have a whole lot to say about back pain. Now, here in the Northeast, and by the time this podcast hits our listeners' iPod, we may be up to our navels in snow, although it's been in the 70s and 60s here on the East Coast for the better part of the winter. That snow is going to hit, and people are going to shovel it, and they're going to hurt their backs.
It's a general piece about how to lift, bend at the knees, don't use your back. Probably more importantly, because people have heard that advice, is things to look out for and signs to look for so that you know when to go see a doctor.
Yeah, when you know it's not just you've pulled a muscle.
Exactly.
Such things as if you got numbness or tingling or sharp shooting pain down one leg or the other.
Exactly. And there's other symptoms that could go along with back pain that can signal all kinds of diseases and conditions. So it's a basic guide to back pain.
Now, also on the back page in the health capsules, a couple things that have been dealt with already in the podcast. Cold weather tips for older adults, for one thing.
Absolutely. The Aging Institute has really been putting out a lot of advice. So
the NIA, as
we
they
cover that
like
in
to
our
be
newsletter.
Called. Also, some of the warning signs of hypothermia. Also, there's been a story that's gotten quite a bit of play in the media in the last part of 2006, how circumcision has been shown to reduce the risk of HIV/AIDS in some folks.
Researchers had noticed before that in certain regions of Africa and Asia, HIV tends to be less prevalent in areas where male circumcision is more common. So some researchers did a study in Kenya, one in Kenya, one in Uganda, to look at this, and they did find that actually men who were circumcised had a lower risk of catching HIV.
And there's all sorts of information on page 4 of the NIH News and Health.
And the featured website is the Star Sleeper website, which is about kids and sleep. And sleep habits start when you're young. Sleep, as I said, is important for stress, and it's good to start good habits early. Garfield is the official spokes cat of this campaign. So that's our featured
website.
Sleepy
cat if there ever was one.
That's true.
A whole lot of stuff packed into 4 pages, the NIH News and Health. How do folks get their hands on one?
They can go to News and Health. That's one word, newsandhealth.nih.gov.
And some clinics, hospitals, libraries.
Any medical center, community health clinic, library who wants to receive complimentary print copies, just get in touch with me. All my information's at the website, newsandhealth.nih.gov.
Well, Dr. Harrison Wine, editor of the NIH News and Health, thanks for joining us, and we'll get you back in here in about a month and tell us what's going on for February.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
It's a common misperception that depression is just another part of getting older.
A lot of people think that. It turns out that actually, though being older means that you're losing friends and family members, depression is something quite different, and it is not by any means a natural part of getting older. Depression in an older person is a reason for treatment. It's a reason for seeking help.
That was Dr. Thomas Insel, director of the National Institute of Mental Health. He said that important life changes we make as we get older can cause feelings of uneasiness, stress, and sadness. For instance, the death of a loved one, moving from work into retirement, or dealing with a serious illness. These things can leave one feeling sad or anxious. But most older adults, after a period of adjustment, regain their emotional balance. Yet, some do not.
Depression sometimes occurs for the first time in people as they get older. And what people don't realize is that this is a real disorder with medical consequences. and it's treatable.
About 2 million Americans age 65 or older suffer from major depression. Another 5 million suffer, but not to such a severe degree. The website www.nihseniorhealth.gov has added depression to its list of health topics. The senior-friendly website is a joint effort of the National Institute on Aging and the National Library of Medicine. That website, once again, www.nihseniorhealth.gov. When we come back, Wally Akinso tells us about a study that shows staying in shape mentally can help older folks maintain their thinking skills. That's next on NIH Research Radio. If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it. At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Do you have the key?
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Earlier in the podcast, we talked about how depression is not a natural part of getting older, nor, necessarily, is losing that mental sharpness, as we hear from Wally Akinso.
Staying in shape mentally could help older folks maintain their thinking skills, according to a new study funded by the National Institute on Aging and the National Institute of Nursing Research. The study showed that certain mental exercises can offset some of the expected decline in older adults' thinking skills and show promise for maintaining cognitive abilities needed to do everyday tasks such as shopping, making meals, and handling finances. Dr. Jeff Elias, the NIA's chief of the Cognitive Aging Program in the Behavioral and Social Research Program, said the research showed that some of the benefits of short-term cognitive training persisted for as long as 5 years.
I think what it means for the elderly in the long run is that certainly old brains can be trained. That is, working in these areas to try and improve one's performance in memory, one's performance in reasoning, or one's performance in speed of processing is possible. Speed of processing was the area that people improved most in. 87% of the people who had the speed of processing training improved immediately after training. 74% improved in reasoning, and 26% improved in memory. So memory was the most difficult for people to achieve improvement in. It's also the most complex, and there's many more ways to forget things than there are, for example, to see something in a pattern or to use your visual speed of processing. So memory is a more complex process. So not surprising that people did not quite as well in that. But nevertheless, if you're an average older individual, chances are if you wish to improve your memory by using these different strategies, you could.
People in the memory, reasoning, and speed of processing groups attended up to 10 training sessions lasting 60 to 75 minutes each over a 5 to 6 week period. The memory group learned strategies for remembering word lists and sequences of items, text, and story ideas and details. The reasoning group learned strategies for finding the pattern in a letter or word series and identifying the next item in a series. The speed of processing group learned to identify an object on a computer screen at increasingly brief exposures, while quickly noting where another object was located on the screen. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Research shows that many folks suffering from alcohol dependence do not have access to specialty treatment, or if they do have access, choose not to take advantage of it. That's why the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism has updated a guide that provides tools that can be used by clinicians to help patients with alcohol problems. According to Dr. Mark Willenbring, director of the NIAAA Division of Treatment and Recovery, this updated guide includes handouts with strategies doctors, nurses, and other healthcare providers can use to help patients cut down on drinking or quit altogether, and information about a newly approved injectable drug used to treat alcohol dependence.
What we're doing right now is to expand access to some effective treatments in these non-addiction specialty settings. We know from research now that alcohol dependence can be treated successfully in a primary care-like setting.
Dr. Willenbring said this update provides clinicians with additional tools to help make that occur.
In particular, what we're excited about is something called medication management support. Like with many other chronic illnesses, alcohol dependence treatment with medications only works if it involves active management on the part of their providers. And the same holds true with depression or diabetes or high blood pressure or any of these things, some kind of disease management that is active, follow-up with a focus on adhering to the medication, encouraging patients to make lifestyle changes, is very important to the success of any treatment.
The guide and related materials are available online at www.niaaa.nih.gov/guide. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us Friday, January 26th, when episode 24 of NIH Research Radio is available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website. That's at www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the Health Star Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there in the podcast webpage. If we use your comment, we'll send you something nice from the NIH gift shop. That email address is schmalfew@od.nih.gov. Once again, it's schmalfew@od.nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.